We start with politics. Time for our weekly conversation with Margaret Brennan, host of CBS's Face the Nation. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, and happy belated Thanksgiving to you.
And to you, too, and your new baby as well. I'm so happy for you.
Thanks.
The president has been, this is bizarre, attacking the Ninth Circuit Court and tangling with John Roberts, too, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Where are we with that entanglement? It was something to see the Chief Justice actually make a statement to the president.
It certainly was. The Chief Justice doesn't normally weigh in on some of these political disputes, but clearly felt that he had to defend the independence of the judiciary. This is something that a lot of Republicans, or traditional Republicans, have been a bit uncomfortable with in terms of the claim that this branch of the U.S. government is either pro-Democrat or pro-Republican rather than pro-enforcement of U.S. law and interpretation of it. And that's what Justice Roberts essentially pushed back at, saying we don't have Obama judges, we don't have Bush judges, we have judges who are, you know, enforcing the Constitution and American rule of law, saying justice is justice and should be blind to politics. You may be skeptical of that, but it's worth noting Chief Justice Roberts was an appointee of the Bush administration, right? He was a Republican appointee. And therefore, you know, many have taken his words as a sign that the president perhaps has gone too far. But then you have the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Chuck Grassley, saying, oh, no, this is just playing politics, and the Chief Justice was sort of out of his lane. He shouldn't have weighed in.
Yeah, and I know Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she gets a lot of flack, too, when she's stepped out and said something about current presidents, and she's backed away from that. So it was something to see the Chief Justice actually speak out. Now, as for Republicans, you said that some were uncomfortable with this verbiage as well, saying there's Obama judges, there's Trump judges, or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
Have we reached a point where any members of the GOP are going to start pushing back on this sort of partisan behavior or hyper-partisan behavior from the president?
Well, you know, you have seen a number of self-described, traditional conservatives come out and criticize this. One of the most notable has been George Conway, an attorney who is also married to Kellyanne Conway, one of the president's chief advisors, who has formed a group arguing that some of these abrogations of institutions and undermining of institutions is truly a danger to the Constitution, and that Republicans should also be concerned about this, that it isn't a partisan issue, it is just an issue about that all Americans should be concerned about. Senator Chuck Grassley, though, when he pushed back publicly, said, look, you know, people weren't critical of Obama when he slammed Supreme Court decisions, but many pointing out this is an unfair parallel because President Obama criticized the decisions of the court but didn't necessarily go after judges of it and painting it in purely partisan terms that way. The point is here, once again, we're talking about and questioning an American institution and looking at it in a different way, having it embroiled in politics. So either you look at this and say the American democratic system is successfully digesting another challenge to it, or you look at it and say, wow, we've once again crossed another barrier here in terms of the flame throwing and the food fight here in Washington.
Right. Down to the border, the military has now been apparently authorized to use lethal force. What do we know about what the military's been authorized to do?
Well, this is actually a lot more tangled and complicated than it seems at first blush. There's what the president said yesterday at Mar-a-Lago when he was speaking to the press in terms of saying he had authorized force. But then when you talk to the defense secretary, Jim Mattis, he has really said, drawn some very clear distinctions in terms of what those who have been deployed, National Guard and U.S. troops, what they're there to do at the border and what they're authorized to do. He said he had received some new guidance, but there's a lot of legal questions about exactly how deploying these U.S. troops on American soil will be carried out. But what Jim Mattis has said is they're not armed. These troops are not armed. They're there essentially, as he's described it, practicing concertina wire and being defense to or backup essentially to Customs and Border Patrol agents, that they are not there as a first line of defense and that they are not armed to be so. They are armed in their own self-defense with shields and things like that. So it's really drawn a lot of scrutiny here as to whether the president deployed these troops in a way that was inherently political because it was around the time of the midterms, or whether they are actually needed in what is Jim Mattis has described as this sort of support role. Any kind of use of force is a whole other conversation here. And this memo that Chief of Staff John Kelly signed off on, there's some different of opinion as to what kind of force it would authorize, who it's actually referring to, and whether it would undermine any kind of legal guidelines there for using U.S. troops on American soil.
And it sounds like we're still waiting for a bulk of the caravan to reach the border.
That's what it sounds like from press reports that I've seen. You know, this movement of individuals had gotten to around Tijuana, Mexico. You heard yesterday from the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, that he's been in touch with his Mexican counterpart, the foreign minister there, to sort of have conversations about asylum or processing and essentially stopping those individuals in the south before they get to the border, shared border with the United States. But clearly, this is something that the president continues to focus on and talk about, saying that this large number of people would be overwhelming to the existing number of Border Patrol agents who have been successfully defending the border between the U.S. and Mexico.
Host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan, this Sunday's Face the Nation will feature Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Angus King. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. It's Black Friday. I hope you're being kind to everyone as you're out there shopping your hearts out. Believe it or not, Georgia, Florida, not the only states with some midterm elections still left over. Washington State has three very close undecided races more than 2 weeks after the midterms, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has been tracking those. Hannah?
Yeah, it's likely these three races are going to be facing recounts. What we're talking about is a couple in the 42nd district. One is a House race that's got Republican Representative Luann Van Werven. She is leading her Democratic challenger, Justin Bonneau. And also in the 42nd, the Senate race between Republican Doug Erickson, senator, who is known as the supporter of President Trump, is facing his Democratic challenger, Pinky Vargas. Also in the 26th district, that's over in Gig Harbor area, we've got Democrat Emily Randall and Republican Marty McClendon. They are trying to both fill the seat that was left empty by the now retiring Republican Jan Angel in the Senate. So that's three races. All of them are separated by just a few dozen votes.
I'm most surprised by the Doug Erickson and Pinky Vargas race because, as you said, Senator Erickson is known as a big Trump supporter. He's the one that threw the, before President Trump became president, that huge rally in Linden. So he had certainly the backing of the president. It seems up in Whatcom County, he would be a very popular choice. I'm not familiar with Pinky Vargas, and how is she able to get so close to Erickson?
Well, she's a Democrat. People really like her. She's also a Bellingham City Councilwoman, so she's known up in that area. And Doug Erickson, you know, he took some hits. Some of the, he had the job that he took with the Trump administration temporarily at the EPA. He was flying back and forth while being at the, you know, serving the legislature at the same time as serving in the Trump administration. And some people up in Whatcom County took issue with that, thought that, that he wasn't doing all he could to represent them. Also, you know, going back a few years, he was outed for some lobbying, having lobbyists pay for his lunches and things of that nature. So he's taken some hits, but he was very confident. I talked to him right before, and he's ahead. He's ahead right now in that race. But again, they're all separated by just a few dozen votes. So here's how it's looking right now. In the House race, Luann Van Werven is in the lead. She is, again, the Republican incumbent. And then Doug Erickson is leading in his race, so he'd be the Republican incumbent. And then in the 26th, newcomer Emily Randall, she has the lead in the 26th over in Gig Harbor, which was a Republican-held seat. So that one has gone back and forth. At this point, they're, all three races are under the what would trigger a hand recount, a mandatory hand recount, which happens when you're the number of votes that are separating the race is below a quarter of a percent is essentially what that is.
So below 150 votes is the machine recount. Below a quarter of a percent is hand recount.
It's a half a percent triggers the machine, and then a quarter percent triggers the hand.
And how long can those take, the hand recounts?
Within just a few days. The Secretary of State, I believe, has to order them within 3 days of the counties certifying their results. Counties have to certify their results the 27th on Tuesday, and then they should be done relatively quickly, within a week or so. And because everyone has to get ready to go, right, and be ready for the next session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when does the next session begin, by the way?
January 8th. January 8th.
Mm-hmm. But do you know what's on tap already for the legislature?
Well, there's certainly several things that are going to be coming up. I want to point out really quickly, too, though, if all of these results hold, which Democrats tell me they do expect them to hold, by the way, State Republican Party Chair Caleb Heimlich gave dire warnings about such results just before the election.
If we lose 8 or 12 or 20 seats, the state legislature is going to look like the Seattle City Council, and that's going to be bad for the taxpayers and hardworking families of Washington State.
So if they lost that many seats, right? You heard the number?
Yeah.
If these results hold in these recounts, then what we're looking at is Senate seats. Democrats pick up 3 more. In the House, Democrats pick up 7 more. So it's right in line with what he was talking about. And when he mentions Seattle politics in Olympia, we're talking about things like state income tax, capital gains tax, getting a carbon tax again put up in front of the legislature. And Democrats at the time said that's scare tactics and not something we're looking at. But it remains to be seen. I talked to Emily Randall right before the election. She's in one of these recounts, likely recount races. And this is what she had to say about our tax structure.
Washington has the most progressive tax code in the country. So I do think that a capital gains tax is a good way to work on writing that upside down tax code, to making sure that the wealthiest 1% in our community and our state are paying their fair share.
And most of the Democratic newcomers I interviewed ahead of the election said the same thing. They supported the idea of a capital gains tax, which will be a heated debate should that come up. But Democrats, if this holds, they'll have a 28-21 majority in the Senate, 57-41 advantage in the House. So much bigger gains than majorities than they had previously.
That's incredible. Based on the results that you're seeing, the candidates you've spoken to, the 8th congressional district was flipped by a Democrat. It looks like a Democrat, Pinky Vargas, is within shot of Republican Doug Erickson's seat. We've got perhaps in the 26th over in Gig Harbor, a Democrat taking that seat. Was Washington part of that blue wave, or I guess they're calling it a blue ripple now?
Since it's something in between a wave and a ripple. Yeah. Absolutely. I would definitely say so. That's a significant number of seats. You know, look, when I started talking to Democrats before the primary, they were focused in on maybe flipping a few House seats, maybe one in the Senate. And again, if these results hold, they'll get 3 in the Senate, which is a big gain. They're very excited about that. I was speaking with them yesterday. 4 would have been an amazing miracle that they would have been excited about. 3 is great. But they were, you know, eyeing 1. So these are better than expected results for them if everything holds the way that it is. And I think it'll make a difference. You know, even though we just saw 1639 pass, expect, even with or without the legal challenge it's facing, the gun control measure, expect to see other gun legislation in Olympia for sure. There's a Senator Jamie Peterson had spoken to me about a bill that didn't quite make it last session that requires that you give up your firearm rights when you're put on an involuntary 3-day hold for a mental health situation, which is not currently covered in our extreme risk protection orders. It's a different thing.
Wow.
So that was something I think that very likely with this kind of Democratic majority, we could see a state preemption repeal bill again, like we've seen in the past. And I think for sure capital gains, another carbon tax measure. Mental health, though, I think we could also see big bipartisan things that go down in the legislature this session. Everyone has said finding ways to do affordable housing, getting our mental health system taken care of is a top priority. Health care is a huge priority. I've heard a lot of the Democrats that I interviewed who are newcomers talk about a multi-state healthcare option plan. So I think you can see all of those things.
All right. The next 2 dates to pay attention to: next Tuesday, the 27th, when counties certify their election results, possibly triggering hand recounts in 3 races. And then January 8th, where the new legislative session begins. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. A good morning to you. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Yes, I'm here live and local this morning. might be the only show that is today on Cairo Radio. We've got a lot of great best ofs coming up for Tom and Curly and Dory and our whole gang here at Cairo Radio. Happy holidays and happy Thanksgiving, belated. Happy Black Friday, if that's a thing. Thanksgiving and the holiday season means delicious food and a lot of it. Avoiding all of the office cookies, the eggnog, the overeating on Thanksgiving, it's difficult. And it leaves many of us feeling ashamed and anxious. Perhaps you ate a little too much yesterday, couldn't stop munching on the appetizers on the counter, ate a whole wedge of pumpkin pie someone handed you. The average American consumed 4,500 calories on Thanksgiving, which is something we're supposed to feel guilty about, right? Well, cheer up. Treat yourself with a little kindness. First of all, overeating one day, that's not a big deal.
Even if you do indulge in more food on one particular day, it is just one day, and your body responds to that by increasing your metabolism, so it literally will burn more energy because it doesn't want you to gain that much weight.
That's registered dietitian Rebecca Strickfield, author of the book Body Kindness. She wants us to all have a little more compassion for ourselves and a little more education about how the holidays affect our weight and health.
You know, unfortunately, it's our dieting culture that has pretty much ruined the holiday for us. We actually look at the science, right? You know, first of all, if people gain weight, it's maybe a couple pounds. It's likely water weight, and people lose the weight that they put on after the holiday season when they get back to their usual habits, when there's more sunlight, when they're more active. And so we really have nothing to worry about.
Food guilt is something many Americans deal with, and most of us are unhappy with our bodies. To the detriment of our health, of course, a new survey from the Cleveland Clinic found about 75% of Americans said they would rather be considered strong rather than thin. Nearly 90% of participants said body image expectations are unrealistic. And Rebecca wants people to know if you're thinking about getting on another diet, that is not the answer.
So diets are about as useful as a space heater in hell. You know, diets are very ineffective. It's like if you went to a physician and the doctor said, here, take this pill, but I guarantee you it's not likely to work. It's not going to work in 85% of the people who take it. You probably wouldn't take that pill. And that's exactly what happens when you diet. And this has been shown in research that our bodies, yes, we need exercise. We need sleep. We need healthy eating patterns. We need to go to the doctor. We need to have fun in life. There are things that we need to be healthy and to protect our health and well-being. But we don't get that from diet.
Diets, of course, are alluring. They offer us a promise of a perfect body quickly. That image we've always imagined.
It literally is addictive. You get a rush of dopamine just imagining what life would be like, being all sexy and svelte and everything. But in reality, you're depriving yourself of adequate nourishment. And that just leads to overeating. It leads to like, oh, forget this, I can't hang on type of eating. So you need to find an eating plan that's workable for you. And that is really going to be different for everyone.
That is Rebecca Strickfield, registered dietitian, author of the book Body Kindness.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Opioids have been declared a public health crisis. Guns are being declared a public health crisis. And in the UK, loneliness has also been declared a public health crisis. And loneliness, as it turns out, is not confined to the UK. We also see it here. And Dr. Danny Lowe, who is at Swedish Cherry Hill, and who sees patients all the time, who are lonely, thinks that this is something that we need to treat as seriously as we do opioids and everything else, correct? And so you wrote an op-ed about this. When you say that people come into you presenting with loneliness, is that what they say? I'm lonely, I want to talk to you?
Usually not. So it's a little bit more complex. And patients who come in with loneliness often may be coming in with depression, may often have anxiety. And unfortunately, there's not really a clinically used tool that we consistently have for loneliness. So usually when we really identify loneliness as something that requires a much deeper conversation, and as such, many physicians aren't recognizing that.
So how do you know they're lonely?
So usually what happens is you have a patient who may present with somatic issues, meaning they may have issues with their body, they may be in pain, they may be depressed, they may be anxious. And what I try and do is I try and ask questions to my patients, not only exploring those specific symptoms, but maybe what's affecting their broader life. And so that may include questions about who are they living with and how often do they get out of the house to see other people and how connected do they feel with their support system. And those are sorts of questions that aren't necessarily in a survey, but might often lead to answers of them being socially isolated, of living by themselves, of not going out very often. Or for those who do, they may, despite having a social circle around them, may feel that they don't connect with someone. And often in articulating this and asking after we identify what's going on in their life, we can delve a little bit deeper into these feelings of loneliness.
And you write that sometimes they come to a place like Cherry Hill, the hospital there, because the receptionists and the nurses and the doctors will talk to them or interact with them in some way.
Absolutely. What happens is that for many community health clinics, we aren't just there as individual doctors who come and go or MAs or nurses, but these are places that patients have come for years, and it's invested in part of the community. And so for many patients, seeing those same people, maybe those people who treated their parents, treated their cousins, know their family and what their story is about, it can be really relieving to be there and be able to chat with someone who you know and who knows your story.
And this is not just about making people feel better about themselves. You say that there are physical consequences to loneliness, that we have to approach this with the same fervor, just quoting from your op-ed, that we address smoking cessation, diabetes, depression, and heart failure.
Yes, so there is data that shows a strong association with loneliness to increases in Alzheimer's disease and cardiovascular disease. And in fact, there's a risk of early mortality of up to 30% with someone who is chronically lonely or socially isolated. And that degree is scary. It's something that we need to take quite seriously as a medical community.
And so in the UK, they actually are writing prescriptions for loneliness. Is there a pill? What does that mean?
So there unfortunately is not a pill. That would simplify things. In the UK, there are ideas of trying to get folks more involved in programs that can address social isolation. And that's one of the ways that we can address loneliness, but it's not the only way, because one thing that's really important is to recognize that there is a difference between social isolation and loneliness. There are some people who may be by themselves and feel totally well, and there may be people who are surrounded by folks and feel really lonely. So I think there's a multi-tiered approach that's required for us to really treat loneliness.
Well, you point out the Parks and Rec programs. We have like a dinner club among our circle of friends where every month we just get together and, you know, have dinner and bring stuff, simple things like that. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's one of the things, absolutely. There's also some innovative models. So in the UK, they have what's called the Silver Line, which is a phone line for people who, when they're feeling lonely, they can call and chat with someone. There's also a program called the Togetherness Program. And in this program, they have weekly phone calls with someone to that individual who's feeling lonely. They have home visits, and they also try to engage them in activities. So just as you're talking about, like a dinner party or a gym or, you know, something else that patient likes to do. The other option is that there's new exciting research being done in West Virginia with what's called the Listen model. And what it functions with is it's a type of therapy that early studies have shown actually can reduce feelings of loneliness, depression, and really engage people back in society in a meaningful manner.
But things like going on hikes together.
Exactly.
Doing trail work together, that kind of stuff. Getting outside with other people. I mean, that can help too, right?
It absolutely can, and I think it's something that we need to be able to refer our patients to, and so having an understanding of what programs exist in your community can be really helpful to connecting patients.
Do you have any idea what percentage of people with physical symptoms would actually be cured by fixing the loneliness problem?
That's an excellent question. I don't know precisely the percentage that would be cured, there is great evidence that through being physically active, being with other people, that the rates of depression, the rates of Alzheimer's disease, the rates of early mortality do decrease. And so any sort of decrease in that would be a success in my book.
And is there anything that that we can point to blame this on? Is one of these things that we blame on social media or just general family breakups, opioids, I don't know, the traffic jams? I mean, what can you point to anything that's making it worse now than it was before, or is it the same as it was before?
It's hard to say, partially because we don't have data from years ago. I think there are many contributing factors, and we're still trying to discover exactly what they are. And I think it's bidirectional. So some people become addicted to opioids because they're lonely, and some people who are lonely then get addicted to opioids. And so when someone is sick, it may cause them to be lonely. They can't do the same activities they did previously. And being lonely can lead to that sickness itself. So trying to discover the kind of directionality of how this works, and is it related to social media? Is it due to environmental changes of the family and the community, is hard to say specifically right now, but it's why we need to have investments in this sort of research, because it is impacting our patients' wellness.
In the meantime, if somebody hearing this says, yikes, that's me, I'm lonely, what do they do? Come to Swedish Cherry Hill and ask for you? What do they do?
We'd love to see them. We welcome all patients. I think it's something that more and more doctors are becoming aware of. And I think it is something that needs to be considered an issue that the medical community can address. So I would encourage you to talk to your provider about that. If you don't have a provider, we welcome everyone at the Swedish Cherry Hill Family Medicine Clinic.
Well, I have a more pedestrian question. Is a loneliness diagnosis covered by insurance?
It is not. So it's not part of the DSM criteria for an actual diagnosis. And that's one of the challenges that we face as well.
Well, that one's going to take longer than our discussion to fix, I'm afraid.
I believe you're right. But I think it doesn't mean we can't start. And working on it now and bringing awareness to this issue is something that I think is really important.
Dr. Danny Lowe, a physician at Swedish Cherry Hill Family Medicine. Dr. Lowe, thanks very much.
Appreciate your time.
It's a perfect time of year to cure some loneliness for somebody. Maybe do that on Black Friday. It's time for our Sports Insider Now from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. You can hear Danny O'Neill weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and More, and weekdays right now, right here on Cairo Radio. Danny, good morning.
Good morning, Colleen.
We are both Huskies. We've got the Apple Cup this weekend, so I know who we're rooting for. Are they going to win, though?
I hope so, and I think so.
Yeah.
I feel, look, I'm painfully self-aware about the effect that I have on others, how people perceive me, whether they're mad, in all things except my Washington fandom.
Yeah.
And my arrogance as a Husky, I am relatively unconcerned with how other people react to that. I expect to win this game.
Well, after pouring that much money into an institution, you're sort of allowed to, right?
I guess. Either that or this is the one part that I've allowed myself to be absolutely insufferable.
Yeah.
Because this is what Huskies do. Like, we walk into the Apple Cup and we see it as an expectation and a rite of passage, and it will be a jarring, I don't want to say crushing defeat, because, look, in the history of these two teams, Washington's gone to 34 bowl games. Washington State's gone to 14.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone to 14 Rose Bowls. They've gone to 4. So depending on how this goes, it's not like the balance of power is going to be altered.
Sure.
But we've got a chance to take their once in a decade season.
Right.
And just ruin it.
Because that's what, I mean, this is a really good team. The fan base got college game day. I mean, they're all wearing mustaches. This is peak Cougar fandom right now. And to snatch that away from them now in the Apple Cup
is beautiful.
You are smiling.
It would be so joyous.
You're like the Joker right now. I feel like I have to look away. It's a little bit scary.
I've loved the last couple years when the Cougs have come in talking themselves into this is going to be the year. And it's been a few years. And then they just get drop kicked, and they've been brutal. The last three games, the average margin, the Huskies won by an average of 25 points. I don't think it's going to be lopsided like that, and Washington State is a really good team.
And it's going to snow.
It might snow. We'll see.
It's going to be cold.
It's going to be cold, but actually, and there's all been all sorts of jokes about how the Huskies don't like to play in snow, and references to the 92 game, and even in 94, it got cold out there, and Washington didn't respond. the bad weather would hurt the Cougs more than it would the Huskies.
How so?
Because the Cougs love to throw the ball. In fact, the Cougs seem to have an aversion to running the ball.
So it's not acclimation, it's how the team plays.
Correct. And a windy or cold and wet, rainy or snowy day probably would affect the way the Cougs play more, given just how many times
they
throw
the ball. And you don't think they can adjust how good this team is? You don't think they can adjust for wind?
Sure they can, and it makes it more unpredictable. Mm. But people will tell you when you introduce bad weather, it tends to negate the talent advantage between the two teams. So if you think that Wazoo is the better, more talented, more cohesive team, well, then bad weather is going to play to Washington's favor because it introduces a variable that makes things more unpredictable. But I think Washington, this is the healthiest they've been all year. Mm-hmm. Left tackle Trey Adams is back. This will be his second game back. Hunter Bryant has played in a couple games. He's their great tight end. I think that this is Washington's offense is playing better than it has all year. And I'm excited. I think they've got a great shot against this. I do expect them to win.
Where are these two teams headed either way?
Well, the winner is going to head to the Pac-12 championship game.
Okay.
And in that way, they'll play Utah. The winner of that game will probably go to the Rose Bowl. Almost certainly go to the Rose Bowl. At worst, will go to the Rose Bowl. It's only the third time where you've had this winner-take-all scenario in the Apple Cup. In 81, if Washington State won, they went to the Rose Bowl. If Washington won and then it needed one other result, it would go to the Rose Bowl. Mm-hmm. Huskies won, went to the Rose Bowl. 2016, they came and the winner won the Pac-12 North championship, and well, the Huskies won that game too. Are you beginning to sense a trend?
I am, in the third
winner take all scenario, we'll see exactly what goes. And the loser, Jim Moore's been giving me a hard time and saying the Huskies are going to go to the Cheez-It Bowl, which is possible.
Is that an actual bowl?
Yeah, there is a Cheez-It Bowl.
Oh boy.
Which I actually, it kind of sounds delicious.
It does.
The Cheez-It's a pretty good snack,
who
right?
I like Cheez-Its.
Yeah, the Cheez-It Bowl is played down in Arizona.
Okay.
So, I'm not sure where the loser will end up going. If it's the Cougs, if the Cougs lose this game, they'll probably end up in the Holiday Bowl. But we'll see. The Pac-12 champ this year almost certainly is going to the Rose Bowl.
What's the lowest of low bowls to be chosen for?
Oh, I'm not sure. Idaho Potato Bowl. Idaho Potato Bowl's pretty low.
This is the name.
Yeah, the Idaho Potato Bowl. There was once upon a time the Poulan Weed Eater Bowl.
No, stop.
Yeah,
it.
The Poulan Weed Eater Bowl.
What is that?
Yeah, it's a weed eater. You've seen a weed eater.
Oh.
It was sponsored by Poulan Weed Eater.
All right. Great. All right. What's going to be the score of the Apple Cup? And here's your last chance to taunt Cougars.
Well, I think it's going to be good. And I don't want the Cougars to be discouraged because you've had a great season.
Oh, come on.
I don't want you to feel bad about anything. It's been magical what's happened over on the Palouse. And they're never going to take away for you that ESPN game day experience. But now the Huskies are going to go marching through. It's going to be Washington 38. Cougs 34.
Ooh, it's going to be that close. Our sports insider, Danny O'Neill. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Thanks, Colleen.
Sports Insider brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers.
Go Dogs!
's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. It's the day after Thanksgiving. This is typically a day my family would go out and watch a movie. I don't know what it was about the day after Thanksgiving, but there's something about sort of tucking yourself away from the big crowds of Black Friday and enjoying yourself. And there's a movie out called Creed 2. This is a continuation of the Rocky series. Michael Medved is here, and you have seen it. What do you think?
I think that this movie is going to deliver for a lot of people who are immersed in the Rocky world. Okay, now, back. Ivan Drago is this Russian fighter, killing machine, huge, imposing guy, played by Dolph Lundgren, if you remember Dolph Lundgren. Mm-hmm. And Rocky eventually fights Ivan Drago after Ivan Drago in the ring kills his friend Apollo Creed. Mm. Okay, so this is set up. This is a generational issue where Ivan Drago has trained his son, who's even bigger and more imposing than he is, to be champion of the world, and he's going to fight Apollo Creed's son, and everyone says, don't do it, don't do it, Adonis, because this is the same family that killed your father. It's a setup.
Sure. Because they're the millennial generation, they decide not to fight, right? They want their safe spaces.
Not exactly.
No.
This is
what a movie.
This movie is very traditional. There are good guys and bad guys. They're pretty clearly demarcated. But the good guys at least have enough dimensionality and a warmth to them that you really end up caring about the movie. Tessa Thompson plays the girlfriend of the main character, Adonis Creed. And then she becomes something more than a girlfriend.
Mm.
And there's a baby. Mm. And there's...
She also a fighter?
No, she's a singer.
Oh, okay.
A hearing impaired singer. Huh. And she's wonderful in the film.
Oh, she's a great actress.
All the performances are great. I mean, Michael B. Jordan is a superstar in the making.
Yeah.
He is extremely watchable. And look, this is a Rocky movie. We are not talking about nuance. We're not talking about intellectual sophistication. But this is a very watchable movie. And as I was with the other Creed movie was, wow. This has energy. It has pizzazz. This may not be quite as successful as the other Creed movie, which was the seventh Rocky movie in the series. But it's hard to imagine somebody going to see this because it is about boxing after all. And there are several, many boxing matches that are dramatized here. It's hard to imagine anybody being frustrated with it or disappointed in it. The movie delivers.
Can you jump in on Creed 2 without seeing Creed 1?
Yes.
Can you jump into Creed 2 without seeing any Rockies?
Yes.
You can.
Yeah, you can. Oh. Because
there's hope for me still, Michael.
Stallone, by the way, is a very good screenwriter. I mean, he wrote the screenplay for the original Rocky, and he peddled the idea, and they originally wanted them to do a screenplay without him playing the title role. They thought he was too small. They thought he was too old. He insisted, and the rest is cinema history. And I don't know of another series that has gone on for quite this long, because let's see, we're talking about almost 50 years.
Right.
It's like 44 years with the same star, and the same stars playing the same roles. And the film is very graceful in its attitudes toward the past. I mean, people are visiting graves all the time in this film. They visit the grave of Apollo Creed, who is almost a presence in the film, even though he's no longer alive. Rocky's late wife, Adrian.
I do know that reference.
You haven't seen the film.
And I know the stair climb. I know all that.
And
but
by the way, it's PG-13.
Great.
There's some really gory boxing violence. And and again, remember, Apollo's dad was killed by Ivan Drago. And Ivan seems to want his son to kill Apollo's son. But we'll see whether that occurs, or you'll see when you go to the movie. It's PG-13 because of the violence. 3 stars for a Creed 2. I know it seems ridiculous. What?
I believe it. I mean, it sounds exciting. There's drama. There's storyline. There's callbacks.
Well,
I love it.
The main thing is there's romance. Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan have real chemistry together. And they're both just so intensely likable. And that's the one thing you come away with. This is the least cartoonish of all of Sylvester Stallone's performances as Rocky.
Okay.
Rocky is now comfortable. He's familiar. He's the real guy. You don't think this is Sylvester Stallone. This is Rocky Balboa. They've kept the people, the familiar characters and the familiar themes in the franchise. And as somebody born in Philadelphia, with my family from Philadelphia, as usual, there's some scenes on the art museum steps and a great affection for the city of brotherly love. Not so much for Moscow. 3 stars.
All right. 3 out of 4 for Creed 2. Have a great Thanksgiving, Michael.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend and vacation.